maybe something useful happened between your entrance and exit. But yeah, that's a great idea.
Thank God.
Certainly. I can imagine Shakespeare saying something pithy like that. And there are many things I still don't know of. Keep looking for that as I parse through the pages.
Which is your favorite?
Ooh. It changes. It's been, I think the first character I fell in love with was Henry V. And as a teenager, there was something. Well, tonight, I'm going to have a sharing of monologues, and Henry V will play an important part in that. But there was something about that as a high schooler that I really needed.
Very heroic.
Yeah, you know, that very much spoke to my lack of position in the world, that I didn't know where I was. And this guy was a very clear model of what it meant to be respected and beloved. And also caring deeply for your comrades. But my feelings about war and combat got a little more sophisticated after that. And I got more interested in Prince Hal, the character before he becomes Henry V, mm-hmm. when he's spending all his time with Falstaff and engaging in all sorts of debauchery.
Party animal.
Party animal, exactly. The original party animal. Well, I'm sure there was the predecessor party animal. Do you have a favorite play?
No.
Does anybody else have a favorite play?
I'm not that, so.
Midsummer Night's Dream.
Midsummer, I hope you can come tonight, because the resident company of the village, the Narnia is lending me them. Narnia and the Miners are lending me their resident acting company to perform Pyramus and Thisbe from A Midsummer Night's Dream tonight. So, if you get a chance, they're going to open up the... 8:30.
Where will it be?
Right here. This wooden O. Well, welcome, everyone. Come on in, and folks might continue to trickle in. And I know there's at least one new face to the sessions, so I wanted to... Anyone who's been at the sessions want to review some of the things we've spoken about so far? We've been... taking a practical approach to the plays, an actor's approach, how we might, not so much a literary one, but a manual, taking Shakespeare's words and internal clues within the text to inform how we might shape a character. And today we're going to look specifically at one. We're going to look at Richard III. So has anybody, from former sessions, are there any things people remember talking about from other sessions?
Well, last night you emphasized that the literature came without punctuation. Mm-hmm. And in trying to read it, there were 6 or 8 people given a chance to read it, and they all came out with different emphasis, and they all got stuck in the same line, which made no sense to anybody until he read it. Because he then emphasized, put the pauses in, and all of a sudden that whole sentence came alive. Mm-hmm. It wasn't just a bunch of words, there was great meaning in it. But none of us found that meaning because there was no punctuation help.
And then from that, the exercise was that we had eliminated all the punctuation from the speech, and everybody was trying to codify it as they went along to make sense out of it. And then after we did realize one of the possible meanings, other people continued to offer more beyond that, which were very rich. So that's what we've definitely talked about, punctuating speech, that editors have given us this punctuation, but it's only useful insofar as it helps us to create a living thought. So we've been talking about dramatizing thought as well. And is anybody here at the first session? Mm-hmm. Do you remember what sort of...
We started by looking at Hamlet's speech to the players. Mm-hmm. And I suppose we were focusing on his... giving them instructions to not overact. Mm-hmm. But this is coming from a guy who is supposedly not an actor. and telling these actors what to do. So.
Yeah, the character of Hamlet is instructing a group of actors how to act. Exactly. And do you remember how he begins it?
Well, all I remember is it's a do not saw the air.
Do not saw the air too much thus, but use all gently. And he begins with, speak the speech, I pray you, as I pronounced it to you, trippingly on the tongue. But if you mouth it, as many of our players do, I had as lief the town crier spoke my lines. So there was some practical advice in there. We want to apply that today. And also we talked about listening a little bit, about how really, and yesterday this came to bear when we realized that in Shakespeare's day, the rolls people received, which were actually parchments rolled up, and from where we get the roll that you'll play in a play, it only had their lines and three cue words from the last speaker. So that's all they had to wait for. They knew the three words that the speaker before them was going to say. They didn't know who the speaker was. They just knew that those three words were eventually going to come, and then it was their turn to engage in the scene. And we were looking at how you can stay active in the midst of that without having words to speak necessarily. And we've talked. And one other thing that I think is quite that's going to come to bear today is the apprehension versus comprehension. As we hold this tension between coining new language and already knowing. We need to know what our words mean. We need to know, you know, that now is the winter of our discontent made glorious summer by this son of York. You know, and then there is a certain quality to knowing from the beginning what you're going to say, and then there is something to, you know, like we talked about Macbeth yesterday. If it were done when 'tis done, then we're well, it were done quickly. That the thoughts are also sometimes being formed as they speak. So it's a sort of balancing those. And so has anybody seen Richard III, the play? Read.
Is that a Kenneth Branagh movie?
Is that a Kenneth Branagh? Oh, with the... Was it, what, when was it?
I don't know, I was in high school.
You were in high school. Ian McKellen? Was it Ian McKellen, do you know? Was it set in kind of Nazi Germany?
Yeah.
So that was Ian McKellen who did that one. And he actually barnstormed across America touring that before they filmed it. That was a big, that was quite a success. And do you remember anything from the...
I remember Nazis,
yeah. Interesting that what you remember is the setting of the play and not the language. It's always a tricky balance to hold in both.
I was like 16 or 17 too.
Yeah. We're looking at what we're kind of the point of today is we want to arrive at the beginning of Richard III, which is an incredibly daunting, you know, Shakespeare was, he had a lot of faith in his leading actor, Richard Burbage, who played Romeo, who played Hamlet, who played Richard III, played all the leading men. And what a thing to make an actor begin the play. So first of all, you don't have lights, you don't have sound. So this guy at some point has to walk on stage in front of a raucous crowd of groundlings who are, you know, doing their business. And nobody yet has an indicator of when this play begins until he says, "Now is the winter of our discontent," which is not a regular rhythm, because normal iambic pentameter would be, "Now is the winter of our discontent," you know, and it's a little harder to grab people's attention. But so it's a little daunting to begin the play as the title character walking on stage, and I think, well, most people in America don't know the backstory of Richard III, which is a really rich one, because in the context of Shakespeare's day, Richard III is the first spin-off. It's the Wolverine to the X-Men, you know, movie franchise. He wrote the first three plays we know of are, you know, really wonderfully titled Henry VI Part 1, Henry VI Part 2, and Henry VI Part 3, followed by Richard III. So you can imagine the excitement this garnered from, like, audiences who loved history. But actually, it is important to note that they would have all known this history, and we don't. So that's another hurdle we have to leap in producing these plays is that we don't have that common knowledge. And actually, does anybody go to Ashland, Oregon? Has anybody ever been to Oregon Shakespeare Festival? What were the last shows that you saw there?
Julius Caesar.
Last year when the woman played Julius Caesar?
Yes.
And how did that work?
I thought it worked wonderfully.
Yeah.
I thought it
was this is a... was she playing... This is a production where they did Julius Caesar at Oregon Shakespeare Festival and a woman played Julius Caesar. Do you know, did she play it as a woman or was she playing it as though she were a man? Was it...
I think it was more... I got the sense more that she was playing it as a woman, a very strong woman, but, you know, definitely not trying to be a man.
Right. And did that add a richness to the...
Well, for me, as a woman, of course it did. But, I didn't talk to very many men about how they felt about it. Because sometimes those switches really throw people off and make them uncomfortable with the characters. But I didn't find it that way. But I... You know, you're kind of, did you?
No, I am from Oregon, but I have a secret. I've never been to Ashland.
Oh, that's okay.
No.
That's what natives of states always do. You never stay alone. points of interest.
Well, that's a really interesting point, and I've talked with other folks who've, when you make those directorial choices, you really need to be intentional. It sounds like that was resonant, definitely.
Mm-hmm.
For you, and I think for other people as well, men so often have the opportunity, well, not so often, but much more often than women, to cross-gender, you know, be cross-gender cast in a play. So you'll, and there is, in Shakespeare in particular, there is a richness to watching, you know, the actor who's playing Viola in Twelfth Night, you know, who would have been a 12-year-old boy.
Right.
You know, we'd use adults, but an adult playing a woman who then pretends to be a man. And of course, for the 12-year-old boy in the original scenario, he's none of those things. He's not a woman, nor is he a man. So there's a huge amount of comedic access that we're, you know, fortunately, we deny ourselves because we need to have women on stage. Fortunately, we can. But I do think there's also a richness to women playing men as men. And I love to see that in particular because men get to do it all the time. You know, it's sort of, but women are often made to be women in male roles, which there's always a kind of, you know, it's a bit like, in some ways it's like layering a sexuality on a character. I want this character to be gay because it will help with my particular agenda, what I want to express with the show. And actually Richard III is a great example because my wife and I last summer saw Richard III played by a woman, a favorite actor of mine. In Stratford, Canada. Does anybody know what the Stratford Festival in Canada? Have you been there? What's the last thing that you saw?
Oh, it was 100 years ago.
100 years ago?
Yeah, when I was in high school. No.
Yeah.
It's great. It was wonderful.
But it was wonderful?
Oh, it was wonderful.
Even as a high schooler. Had you already liked Shakespeare at that point?
Yes.
Or?
Yes.
So you were already...
Yeah.
You
my,
were
high
already
school, my high school did Shakespeare every year.
They fed you the Kool-Aid. Good. But sometimes, I think high school kids do go to Stratford and it becomes... Not having loved Shakespeare in it, and it can be a life changer. But this woman played Richard III, and she played him as a man, and there were all sorts of levels of, you know, androgyny going on there that were really rich. And she had this great wig that was, you know, kind of, you often have Richard III with a long wig, but she had this great bald patch in the back of her head. It was just kind of a, you know, had a great, you know, bunch-backed toad quality to it for a moment there. But, yeah, so Richard III has to begin the play. And it's so funny, I'm reminded of when we had the parade here. Everybody, you know, everybody wants to take the pressure off the actor. Like, how can we do this so I don't have to say, now is the winter of our discontent? You know, how can I make some gimmick out of this? Because everybody knows this line, now is the winter of our discontent. So it's a bit like To Be or Not to Be, not as famous. But, now how can I get around? You know, how can I sort of, you know, be clever and coy? And one production I heard about that was pretty neat... the actor comes out, you know, and he gets up to center stage, and he goes. And all of a sudden, you hear this parade. All these trumpets start blaring, and across the stage walks his brother, who's king, you know, and they're all dancing, because that's sort of a theme in the play, is that Edward is really into parties and dancing, and so Richard is just standing there, and everybody walks by, celebrating and enjoying the piece, and then everybody finally leaves, and he goes, "Now is the winter of our discontent." You know, sort of a fun. And then there are actually a production I saw of those Henry VI plays, the three of them, the last part of Henry VI. Since "Now is the winter of our discontent" is the famous beginning of Richard III, this actor who played. And confusing, I'll pass out these sheets in a second, but the name of the character at the beginning of the play, Richard, his name is Gloucester, because he's the Duke of Gloucester. He's right here. So he actually isn't king at the beginning of the play. The play is about him becoming king. So he's Gloucester at the end of Henry VI, Part 3. His brother Edward, who is king, oldest brother Edward, who is finally king. So their family, the Yorks, are in power. He has a baby. He's got a new baby, and he very foolishly hands him to Richard, and Richard is holding the baby, and he's left on stage alone, and he's holding the baby, and he goes, "Now," and the lights go out. And so it's the end of Henry VI. You all know it's sort of like inside Shakespearean joke, but it was really, there was a pretty satisfying gasp in the audience about it. You know, and then that's going to be the focus. He's got to kill this baby. Yeah. He's got to kill this guy's children in order for him to be king. So it sort of establishes that. So establishing is exactly what we're doing, trying to figure out who this character is. Because we do have, well, Richard appears for the first time in Henry VI, Part 2. So Henry VI, Part 2 and Part 3, and then comes into his own completely in Richard III. Unfortunately, nobody does Henry VI, Part 1, 2, or 3. As you can imagine, it's a kind of hard play to sell. Nobody really wants to see the numerals that bad. And Richard III and Henry V seem to be the only ones that...
I think they did it in Ashland.
Mm-hmm. Oh, they did. And people do it. It's just Ashland, a place that, you know, has the resources and the company and a devoted enough group of followers will be able to put on that kind of courageous programming. But for the most part, when you see Richard III, it's alone, usually. And it's in isolation from the rest of those plays. Does anybody have any questions so far about what I'm explaining about this tetralogy of plays? That actually Shakespeare's audience, he wrote Henry VI Part 1. It was so popular, he had to write a sequel, Henry VI Part 2, aptly titled, and then Henry VI Part 3, and then the spinoff, because the character of Richard was so popular.
Yep. Did Shakespeare, you think, in all these plays, since he probably knew the sequence was going to go on, and the people knew the history, are there lines in it that they would get, and we go, all right, if you don't know the back history and stuff, you don't get the joke?
Absolutely. So many of these. That's why, I mean, Richard III, most Shakespeare is cut, but it's generally cut to ribbons, because so much of this is an inside joke about people who have seen these other plays. You don't really need to spend too much energy explaining who's been killed if you've already seen it. And so when people do this in sequence, when they do, when I was in London, they were preparing to do the whole octology. So beginning with Richard II, Henry IV Part 1, Henry IV Part 2, Henry V, Henry VI, Part 1, Henry VI, Part 2, Henry VI, Part 3, and Richard III with the same company of actors. Oh, wow. Imagine watching how much clearer it is when you've seen Prince Hal in Henry IV, Part 1, with Falstaff, and then you've seen him and his father and that dynamic, that painful dynamic of the father who wants him to be a good heir apparent, and Prince Hal, who has this idea of, you know, gaining the common touch. What?
Party boy,
but you know, he's got this vague idea that this will really help him be a really, you know, connect with the commoners once he's actually king. And, you know, to a great, he did have the common touch by the time he was That's what they said about him when he was king. But then you see him develop from Henry IV, part one, and Henry IV, part two. And then, wow, Henry V arrives. But then Henry V dies, and then we have these Henry VI plays. So, I mean, that was the ultimate example of the context. And nobody, I wish that could happen in America, but actually, I wish that this program that actually, again, we're talking about Oregon a lot, but I think they deserve a lot of attention because they have an initiative to chronicle American history now. They've started commissioning playwrights to write stories about major events, watershed moments in American history. So they've got one about the Black Panthers going on right now, got one about LBJ. And it's a really, I think it's a really, has anybody heard of that or seen any of those? I actually haven't seen the shows yet, but.
In St. Paul, Minnesota, we have a history theater that does pretty much all different pieces of, all different types of history. Yeah. American, European, whatever, but it all has a historical theme to it.
Yeah, it's a great theater. I think that's they do a great balance of educational and quality theater. It's a great theater.
It's interesting that China has Nixon in one of their operas, and he's revered there as the opener of the whole cultural thing. But here he's not thought of that way.
Great.
I don't know why.
So, is Henry V?
Yeah, is it a war play?
Henry V is a war play. Okay. If you have the chance to come tonight, there will be several monologues from Henry V going on in this room. But yeah, it's pretty much, and people have taken it from both ends, anti-war and pro-war play, depending on Henry V was kind of a.
Oh, is that the storyline? It's like it's set in the war, like they're at war.
Yeah, they're at war with France.
Oh, okay.
They're at war with France. Yeah, sorry. Kenneth Branagh's Henry V really takes on a sort of darker, anti-war-ish. I mean, it's like you can't really, you're really fighting against the play if you try and make Henry an anti-hero because he really is this much beloved figure. But so I would love to, before I hand up these papers, let's just get a sense of what Gloucester is saying at the beginning of Richard III. So then hopefully, by looking at these other speeches and by looking at maybe taking the listening as what we talked about on that first day, we're going to listen to what other characters have said about him, what he said about himself, and trust that in Shakespeare, that sarcasm is, these plays are not as replete with sarcasm as we necessarily want them to be. This contemporary, tendency to roll your eyes when you mention God, or, these were huge things like God, and actually truth-telling. Unless a character in Shakespeare tells you, I'm going to lie to these people, I'm going to tell them something like Iago, you can basically trust that they're telling the truth, that, there's certainly hyperbole, but there's a kernel of truth in there, I think, in everything everyone says in Shakespeare, unless they tell you otherwise. So this is a speech to which we want to return eventually, and it goes, now is the winter of our discontent, made glorious summer by this sun of York, and all the clouds that lowered upon our house in the deep bosom of the ocean buried. Now are our brows bound with victorious wreaths, our bruised arms hung up for monuments, our stern alarums changed to merry meetings, our dreadful marches to delightful measures. Grim-visaged war hath smoothed his wrinkled front. And now, instead of mounting barbed steeds to fright the souls of fearful adversaries, he capers nimbly in a lady's chamber to the lascivious pleasing of a lute. But I, that am not shaped for sportive tricks, nor made to court an amorous looking glass. I, that am rudely stamped, and want love's majesty to strut before a wanton ambling nymph. I, that am curtailed of this fair proportion, cheated of feature by dissembling nature, deformed, unfinished, sent before my time into this breathing world scarce half made up, and that so lamely and unfashionable that dogs bark at me as I halt by them. Why, I, in this weak, piping time of peace, have no delight to pass away the time, unless to spy my shadow in the sun, and descant on mine own deformity. And therefore, since I cannot prove a lover, to entertain these fair, well-spoken days, I am determined to prove a villain, and hate the idle pleasures of these days. Plots have I laid, inductions dangerous, by drunken prophecies, libels and dreams to set my brother Clarence and the king in deadly hate, the one against the other. And if King Edward be as true and just as I am, subtle, false, and treacherous, this day should Clarence closely be mewed up about a prophecy which says that G of Edward's heirs the murderer shall be. Thy thoughts down to my soul, here Clarence comes. So this is the beginning of the play, and it'll be fun to go through these other pieces I'm going to hand out now and see what echoes there are, so that how much more satisfying it would be to hear that speech. And generally when this play is done, because people haven't had somebody explain this to them. That's not up here.
What? Do I want to do it?
Yeah. And if people are able to share, it would be great. Does anybody have any? One more over here.
Oh, great.
So these are speeches you offer. Oh, we have some more if people still need them. So this is some of my favorite detective work, what I was saying about the listening. We have to listen to what other characters have said, what truthful utterance there's been about Richard. I'm just going to go through, I've culled some descriptors and descriptions of Richard. So, wolf, persecutor, executioner, murderous villain, generous villain, devil, crookback prodigy, and I love this one, grumbling voice. You know, that's so evocative to me. What is that? There's many things that could mean, but he's described at some point as having a grumbling voice. He's also called Misshapen Dick, which is harder to play in a contemporary sense, I've seen it go all sorts of ways. And his brothers once describe him really wonderfully. They say, they ask, where's Richard? And they say, he's gone to the tower, ostensibly to kill somebody. And they say, he's sudden if a thing come in his head. So foul, deformed, dog, he's often called a dog. Troubler of the world's peace. And then there's this great line, that another one of these kind of grumbling voice lines that take it or leave it, but no sleep close up that deadly eye of thine. So this idea of like, well, is he a cyclops? Or what, you know, what does that suggest? And when Bridge Over the River Kwai, Alan what was his name? Guinness. Alan Guinness played Richard III. Alec Guinness. The first season of Stratford. The first season of the Stratford Festival in Canada, Tyrone Guthrie wanted to create a flagship regional theater in North America, so he went to Canada. Before he created the Guthrie in Minneapolis, he created the Stratford Festival, and he had to bring his British actors over, and he brought Alec Guinness to play Richard III. And there are these production photos, and it's this great thing. Apparently, Alec, according to fellow company members, hated this thing, but they did this really interesting thing with his eye. It was just a slight distortion where they achieved it with sort of like spirit gum and glue. But the one eye was just odd looking. And it was so much effect with a fairly small, apparently not for Alec, but it didn't look like there was too much that had been done to achieve that. And I've seen another production where there was a sort of two-face approach where a guy had like a dead half of his face, and so one eye didn't work and he dyed one half of his hair one color, one half the other color, and then one eye was like had a fake contact in it. And so, but it's an interesting, I mean, something that you could really run with, I think. I love this one. Elvish marked abortive rooting hog. So, I mean, you know, we're now in Lord of the Rings territory. I mean, so hog, also, that's another major image for Richard, because that's his crest. He has the boar. The boar is his crest. So that's another one you can draw on. Slave of nature and the son of hell. And that opens up a whole other door. And these are more slander of thy mother's womb, loathed issue of thy father's loins, rag of honor. That's a great... we always talk about flags. So a rag of honor. Bottled spider. There was a famous production with Anthony Scher where there's a great, actually, if you're looking for a wonderful memoir about a year of an actor, Anthony Scher is a visual artist as well as an actor. He's South African. And he chronicled the year when he first heard he was going to play up until opening night of Richard III. And he was incredibly, what I'm talking about, this sort of the burden of Richard III. This it's called the character actor's Hamlet. There's just so much pressure, and Olivier's film looms so large for everyone because it's a terrific film. If you get a chance, you should really see his version of Richard III. And he based his on a much hated theater director named Jed Harris, only to find out later that also Disney had based The Big Bad Wolf on Jed Harris as well. But so he kind of sort of went the wolfy route, and he's got this little page boy haircut. You should really see it, but it's infuriated actors for a long time that they've had to, a lot of them just don't ever see it because they don't want to be completely in its shadow. But so Anthony Scher, he went with the bottled spider. He said, okay, I need an entry point. I gotta stop looking at Olivier. I'll go with bottled spider, and he had crutches. And so everywhere he walked along the stage, he had created this kind of incredible syncopation where, and he would use it, in the Lady Anne scene, he would kind of cozy up and sort of lift up her dress with his cane. And it was everything. It was a prod. It was a, it became a great prop rooted in the language. And then poisonous bunch-backed toad. And he did a lot of pictures actually in this memoir of like trying to figure out what his image was going to be. So he has these great images of toad-like Richards. And then the last bit I love, that this is what Henry VI. So we talked about Henry V, the war play, right? And Henry V is the great conqueror. He conquers France. He has a son, Henry VI, who doesn't want to be a king. He wants to be a shepherd. And he loses all of France in the course of his reign. And this is the beginning of the War of the Roses, essentially, because I haven't detailed it out, but Edward III, it all stems from Edward III. And there are arguably claims from both sides that they should be the rightful king, and this is played out in detail in those Henry VI plays. But Henry VI is you're going to find out, killed by Richard in the course of this play. And what Henry says to him before he kills him is he says, "The owl shrieked at thy birth, an evil sign. The night crow cried, a boding luckless time. Dogs howled, and hideous tempest shook down trees. The raven rooked her on the chimney's top, and chattering pies and dismal discord sung. Thy mother felt more than a woman's pain, and yet brought forth less than a woman's hope. To wit, an undigested and deformed lump, not like the fruit of such a goodly tree. Teeth hadst thou in thy head when thou wast born, to signify thou camest to bite the world." So, I mean, a culture that really is pretty superstitious, and although also Christian, but very superstitious and really subscribing to the physiognomy that if you have an ugly outside, it's really just reflecting your kind of corrupted inside. So I think having these details in approaching Richard offers a richness that you're not really afforded in Richard III. Because Richard III is like the barnstorming. You know, it's the spin-off. It's not meant to be the character builder. It's not meant to give you the whole sense of who this guy is. You're supposed to already know. In some ways, it's like the icing on the cake. So I'd love to read through this, and actually whenever anybody has a question, we can stop. But I actually think, so this is the first time Richard is alone. Are there any questions? Are there any questions so far? Yeah.
Is he truly a hunchback?
Well, you mean historically?
Yes.
No, we don't know that. There's a whole society for the restoration of Richard III's character. It's really great. You know, because, I mean, Shakespeare, it's a great character, but it's just not true. We don't know this about him. There are a lot of accounts that he was this kind of mild, meek guy, and he got beat at, you know, he got beat on at Tewkesbury and died. And then, you know, whoever took over, of course they're going to, you know, they're writing the history. And but anyway, thank goodness we do have this character. But yeah, there's no actual historical documenting. We don't have any of his shirts with, like, you know, hump stretch marks or anything to prove. But Shakespeare definitely is. I mean, Shakespeare refers to this enough. So as soon as there's a question about this, let me know if you have Martha.
Well, the first speech we're looking at, what play is it from?
The first one we're looking at is from Henry VI, Part 2. It's the first soliloquy of Richard's. It's the first time we have him alone with us. And he's going to... And I love it. It's one of my favorite soliloquies in the whole canon. It's really... It is pretty long. But, he goes through so many changes. And so whenever anybody has a question, feel free to just... I'll try to keep my eyes up so we can talk about it. And I might actually stop partway through just to... So Edward and George... His brother. People follow that these are brothers, and so forth. In order for him to get to the crown, he would have to get rid of both Henry and Henry's son. And now, at some point, yeah, read.
So the Henrys, those are Lancasters.
Lancasters, exactly.
And so it's a different house.
Different house.
Yeah. And then Richard III is the third son.
He's the third son, yeah.
Of the Duke of York.
Yeah.
Okay.
And there is actually a fourth son who's dead, but and he's referred to too. But,
are these somehow related to the Game of Thrones?
Yeah,
I would say so. Yeah.
Shakespeare based his play off the Game of Thrones.
Good thing. Great. So, Edward is famous. You know, does anybody remember the language about? Lascivious pleasing of a lute, delightful measures, all this language about dancing. Well, that's referring to Edward. So this first line is a direct reference. So we're laying in this idea that Edward is wanton and Edward loves the ladies. And he's actually just decided to marry a commoner, which is, like, to his brothers, a ridiculous choice. But he's marrying out of love. You know, early characterized as lustful. So that would just be a repetition, what we read in that now is the winter of our discontent. So it first appears here, this idea. Edward will use women honorably. Would he were wasted, marrow, bones, and all, that from his loins no hopeful branch may spring to cross me from the golden time I look for. And yet, between my soul's desire and me, the lustful Edward's title, Berried is Clarence, Henry, and his son, young Edward, and all the unlooked-for issue of their bodies to take their rooms ere I can place myself. A cold premeditation for my purpose. Why, then I do but dream on sovereignty, like one that stands upon a promontory and spies a far-off shore where he would tread, wishing his foot were equal to his eye, and chides the sea that sunders him from thence, saying he'll laid it dry to have his way. So do I wish the crown, being so far off, and so I chide the means that keeps me from it, and so I say I'll cut the causes off, flattering me with impossibilities. My eyes too quick, my heart o'erweens too much, unless my hand and strength could equal them. What? Say there is no kingdom then for Richard? What other pleasure can the world afford? I'll make my heaven in a lady's lap. Deck my body in gay ornaments, in which sweet ladies with my words and looks. Oh, miserable thought. And more unlikely than to accomplish 20 golden crowns. Why, love forswore me in my mother's womb. And for I should not deal in her soft laws, she did corrupt frail nature with some bribe to shrink mine arm up like a withered shrub, to make an envious mountain on my back where sits deformity, to mock my body, to shape my legs of an unequal size, to disproportion me in every part like to a chaos or an unlicked bear whelp that carries no impression like the dam. And am I then a man to be beloved? Oh, monstrous fault to harbor such a thought. Now, since this earth affords no joy to me, but to command, to check, to forbear such as are a better person than myself, I'll make my heaven to dream upon the crown, and whiles I live, to account this world but hell, till my misshaped trunk that bears this head be round impaled with a glorious crown. And yet, I know not how to get the crown. For many lives stand between me and home, and I, like one lost in a thorny wood that rents the thorns and is rent with the thorns, seeking a way and straying from the way, not knowing how to find the open air, but toiling desperately to find it out, torment myself to catch the English crown. And from that torment, I will free myself, or hew my way out with a bloody axe. Why, I can smile, and murder whiles I smile, and cry content to that which grieves my heart, and wet my cheeks with artificial tears, frame my face to all occasions. I'll drown more sailors than the mermaid shall. I'll slay more gazers than the basilisk. I'll play the orator as well as Nestor, deceive more slyly than Ulysses could, and like a Sinon,
Take another Troy. I can add colors to the chameleon. Change shapes with Proteus for advantages and set the murderous Machiavel to school. Can I do this and cannot get a crown? Tut. Were it farther off, I'll pluck it.
Could you follow the sort of narrative arc? So we get, I think this one's really telling because if Richard leans into his deformity at this point, if it actually does make him angry, Max is a great production where, you know, in terms of deformities Richard has, this one, the whole play so far, he's kind of got this like frumpy haircut. And he's Richard, so he's always off, and that's one of the reasons we're drawn to him. But when he gets to this point, when he gets to like an unlicked bear whelp that carries no impression like the damned, he rips off his wig and reveals this pretty hideous birthmark that's kind of got this tufts of hair coming out of it. And I mean, really great dramatic device to take a wig off in a play. I mean, anytime somebody takes a wig off, we sort of... There are a few of these things, you know. Taking a wig off. Spitting is another one Shakespeare uses. But there are certain things that really arrest us. Any thoughts about this speech? The kind of nature of this one? Yeah, Reed?
Are there any productions of Richard III that use this at all? It seems pretty like necessary into getting into his character and why he's doing the things that he's doing. And if Shakespeare wrote it with the expectation that people had seen this earlier, then maybe it was, you know, maybe it needs to be there in order for Richard III to make sense.
It's a great question. I think it's true. It's just that Now is the Winter of Our Discontent is so famous, and it is a great speech. You know, I prefer this one, but I think he's younger in this. You can sort of get the sense of a kind of, he doesn't know himself yet. He's really doubt, you know, he doesn't know what he's doing yet. And so he's not quite Richard yet, but Olivier does this. He lifts text from this for his Now is the Winter, the beginning of that play. He borrows from this, which I think is wise because it's never as good as having a full play to, you know, figure out the character, but there are certainly bits you can draw from. Some people play, the next scene we're going to talk about is the scene in which he kills Henry VI. And a lot of people, actually, it's the second to last scene, it's the penultimate scene of Henry VI, part 3, and some people begin the play that way, Richard III, you know, to give that context. And I think that's a good choice.
I'm just watching you do it, and the fact that you've got the board here. I come from a set design type background, and I was just thinking, you know, it's great to have this his lair someplace where he has a lot of stuff up on boards and red threads.
It's true, yeah, it's a great idea.
He can be at a desk, you know, and going back and looking at it and changing things. Or you
know. Yeah, no, it's like a chessboard, you know, it really is. I hadn't thought of that as an actual, but it's so helpful, I find, because...
Across to the audience.
Yeah.
Yeah, if as an audience, it's so hard to keep these Edwards, you know, because, you know, G of Edward's heirs, that's actually Edward up here that's referring to, Edward III. So, you know, it's like, of course, now we have this, we have his brother Edward, we have the, you know, this Edward who's dead at this point. But, yeah, I think it would be fun to have a...
It's G.
Yeah, G. G as in...
George.
George, yeah. So that's, you know, Al Pacino did this thing called Looking for Richard, and... Because people have so much trouble with this G of Edward's heirs, what does that mean? His name is Clarence. Why is he calling him G? Well, if you were in the other plays, you would have known his name was George. And so that's what G refers to. So actually, he changes it to C, you know, as in Clarence. C of Edward's heirs. But it's just a, you know, a product.
And you lose the... lose the pun.
You lose the pun. Yeah, these concessions we have to make without context. But... I do think a production with like a very prominent family tree would be kind of really perfect for a play like this, or in a, you know, what would, with gravestones somewhere.
so you could sort of track it all.
Yeah.
Just have their pictures on the wall.
Well, I like the, yesterday we did the, that was what we were trying to figure out with the punctuation, his speech when he's all discombobulated.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact that right now in a different play, as a youthful character, he's still at war with himself.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you were really playing out that, well, but I couldn't do that, but you know, I will do this, but I can't, you know, he goes back and forth again.
So. That's a great point, and I think maybe that's where he begins and ends in some ways. And in the middle, instead of the middle being the beginning of Richard III, maybe that's his height of confidence. You know, maybe that's actually, he doesn't begin loathing himself there. Maybe cheated, deformed of feature. You know, I love it. I own it.
Yes.
You know, this is me. There's nobody like me
exactly.
in the world. Instead of, you know, he's like acclimated himself to the world. Unfortunately, it's to become a murderer. You know, like nobody has helped him belong
right.
his whole life. I mean, we'll hear it in the next speech even more. But I think that's so much a part. You grow up your whole life with people reminding you what you look like and what you were like when you were born and what a disappointment you were to so many people. And of course, you idolize your warlord father. You know, like, well, the psychology of Richard, I think, has more layers than a production of Richard III alone can really capture. Were there any other questions about this one that we just did in the middle of Henry VI part? I'm sorry, Henry VI part 3. I said Henry VI part 2. This is about the middle of Henry VI part 3. So it's.
I think we see this with modern television where there's a whole series of every week there's a new thing.
Mm-hmm.
But I joined Game of Thrones at the very last, and I was totally lost, and I'm having to kind of see them somehow at the beginning to sort out all these characters. And I finally just said, I quit. I give up trying to sort out. I'll just follow along, and hopefully it'll make sense later on. And what you're showing is that Richard III is maybe the fourth or fifth or sixth in a series.
Exactly. Serial.
It's a serial.
Yeah.
But you're going to miss so much if you only start with the sixth one.
It's true.
Yeah, actually, this is the eighth. This is the eighth, if you want to think about it that way.
Yeah.
I mean, in the series of, in the octology, this is the very, though, you know, Shakespeare wrote the second four first, and then the other four later, but chronologically. But chronology was always a struggle for Shakespeare.
Yeah.
What was that?
Just like Star Wars, get the prequel first.
That's true. Except these prequels are good. but yeah, it is that. It's actually a good technique. I always wonder whether Shakespeare knew. You gotta sort of imagine he was gonna write Henry V, because Henry VI, one of the big issues with those plays is that they're so unfocused. They don't have. Henry VI is not really the lead. Richard Burbage didn't play Henry VI. So, you know, he wasn't actually. And I mean, really, Richard emerges as. But also York in those plays has a huge function, and so does Henry VI's protector, because he's quite young at the beginning of the plays when he's crowned. At the beginning of Henry VI, he's a young king. He's not able to make decisions on his own, so he has the Lord Protector. And a lot of the plays...
Seeing, you would say, the public would know the stories,
mm-hmm.
the general history.
The history.
What they're doing. Do you say, would you say Shakespeare then took that history knowledge and then put his own spin on the history?
I'd say absolutely. Absolutely. There's actually an account. It's interesting to read. Tonight you'll hear the Crispin's Day speech, which is one of the kind of gems of the canon. But there's actually, somebody came home and transcribed what Henry V said the morning of the battle. So there's this kind of prose version of what Henry V's speech to the troops, and knowing the actual one Shakespeare wrote, it's hard to imagine that they actually won the battle with whatever Henry said. So he was, you know, and there were also other versions of Henry V plays. I mean, people had other, you know, editions. Yeah?
Great.
Queen Elizabeth was a descendant of someone involved in this, right?
Yes.
And that's part of it, too.
Henry VIII. So yeah. What happens is, after the end of Richard III, Henry VII wins. You know, he's seen as this, yes, angelic figure that comes in to restore order. Then his son will be Henry VIII. And then Henry VIII, Henry VIII will do his thing, but eventually Elizabeth will emerge.
And so part of Shakespeare's motivation may have been, make the Queen's grandpa look good, kind of thing.
Exactly. Certainly. That was a very, very shrewd on his part, that I need Richmond is the name of the character, Richmond, Henry VII. Yeah. He emerges as this sort of savior figure. And also, how much flex? I mean, I think he really pressed against those edges of how much he was able to write politically. I think he was a master of that, because Henry V is the ideal Christian king, not Elizabeth's, direct descendant. But he also is really riddled, there are also moments at which I think you should really doubt his choices, whether he should be going off to France to, endanger. And I mean, the odds are 4-5 to 1 against the English. It's essentially a suicidal. And we know the sort of historical thing is that it rained forever. And so, like, all the knights in the English were all, had a lot of bowmen. And the French were all on horses and heavy, heavy armor. And as soon as they fell off, they just drowned to death, because it was the field. It had been raining so long that Agincourt was just a mud bath. And so having armor was of very little use, actually, in the end. So, it's not very interesting for a play to have that be the reason that the English, win. But I think does anybody have any more questions before we go on to this third piece? So now what's happened is, this is the penultimate scene of Henry VI, part 3. We've been following Richard at this point. Henry VI is in jail. Edward is king, but you can't just kill him. He's in jail. So until Richard comes to visit him, they have this scene. Henry says what I said before about, and Henry is like a prophet. He's a very devout Christian. Henry VI, that king. And part of his character is that he just wants to be a shepherd. He doesn't want to have to deal with fighting and battles. And yet he says what he said about Richard, which is not a very loving thing to say to your neighbor, albeit the neighbor that's about to kill you, but and has killed your son. So at this point, Edward is dead, and Henry VI is almost dead. And so that's the context. Actually, no, at the beginning of the speech, well, we'll say almost dead. But he's sitting over his body that he's just stabbed. Says, "What? Will the aspiring blood of Lancaster sink in the ground? I thought it would have mounted. See how my sword weeps for the poor king's death. Oh, may such purple tears be always shed from those that wish the downfall of our house. If any spark of life be yet remaining, down, down to hell, and say I sent thee thither. I, that have neither pity, love, nor fear. Indeed, it's true what Henry told me of. I have often heard my mother say, I came into the world with my legs forward. Had I not reason, think ye, to make haste and seek their ruin that usurped our right? Midwife wondered, and the women cried, oh, Jesus, bless us, he's born with teeth. So I was. Which plainly signified that I should snarl and butt and play the dog.
Men, since the heavens have shaped my body so, let hell make crooked my mind to answer it. I have no brother. I am like no brother. And this word love, which graybeards call divine, be resident in men like one another and not in me. I am myself alone. Clarence, beware. Thou keepst me from the light. But I will sort a pitchy day for thee. For I will buzz abroad such prophecies as Edward shall be fearful of his life. And then, to purge his fear, I'll be thy death, counting myself but bad till I be best. King Henry, the prince's son are gone. Clarence, thy turn is next. Counting myself but bad till I be best. Now throw thy body in the neighbor room and triumph, Henry, in thy day of doom. A little mix up at the end there, but did anybody, any thoughts on that one in terms of humanizing Richard's
Richardness? Humanizing or demonizing?
Humanizing or demonizing, yeah. I mean, how much do we hear that as really inhuman, or is that, does that give us another lens into what, you know, hearing your mother tell you how countless times?
Well, it's kind of like you had said earlier, that this notion of people, that what's on the outside isn't what's on the inside, is that he's completely bought into that.
So yeah.
Because I have this, I'll be this. Because I'm like this, I'll act like this.
Mm-hmm. Does he buy into it, or is he using it? You know, or what?
Yeah, it was just because it seems like he's making a conscious choice to live into identity, mm-hmm. saying mm-hmm. that if the world's going to cast me this way, fine. I'll just go there.
Mm-hmm.
You see the same attitude in people with addiction problems, where they say, this is just the way I am. I have no choice. Mm-hmm. I know it's bad. I know it's wrong.
Right.
But it's just who I am.
So that's a pretty great thing note to end on. I think there's something at least deeply human about it. And that there would be choices to make there, whether as an actor, whether does he buy into it? Does he play against it? What are the... But I think knowing that he grapples with it is what we really need to see before we can really figure out what this now is all about. Thank you.
Thank you. When are you next performing?
You mean in...
Today.
Oh, today. 8:30 is the sharing.
Where are you next performing in Minnesota Theater?
Actually, the History Theater. Is the next.